Listening to the news can feel like a journey, but the 1A podcast guides you beyond the headlines and cuts through the noise. Let's get to the heart of the story together. Listen to the 1A podcast from NPR.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Are you thinking more about how to tighten up your budget these days? Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. And today, we bring you the conclusion of our three-part series, After Ayotzinapa, about the disappearance of 43 Mexican college students. We left off last week in the spring of 2016, a year and a half after the students disappeared. Omar Gomez Trejo is a man without a country. He had to flee his native Mexico after he and a group of international investigators held a press conference accusing some of the country's most powerful officials of covering up what really happened to those students. The Organization of American States had formed a group of independent investigators known as the GIE because the parents did not believe the government's version of events. The government claimed a local gang was behind the attack, but Omar and the independent investigators found evidence of a much broader conspiracy. They suspected the government had planted and concealed evidence and coerced confessions to cover up for state and federal officials who were connected to the attacks. They concluded that the government was trying to make it look like a local crime and close the case quickly. When the independent investigators released their findings about the suspected conspiracy, Mexican officials were furious, and experts left in fear, returning to their countries. They convinced Omar to leave too. Omar ends up going to Honduras and working on another human rights case for the UN, but he's struggling. He can't get the Ayotzinapa case out of his mind, and neither can Jim Cavallaro from the Organization of American States. He wants to keep the case open, but from Washington, D.C. So on a trip to Honduras, Jim tracks down Omar, and they go out to dinner.
So I get to dinner with Jim, and he says, "What are you doing here?" And I say, "Nothing. I'm sick of Honduras. I just quit my job." If I can't stay in Mexico, I'm going to get a little piece of beach in Panama, open up a little bar. And Jim's like,
¿Qué estás diciendo, loco? No.
Are you crazy?
Renuncia.
Resign, take a little vacation, do whatever you want. But I want you in Washington by the 1st of April.
Okay.
Reveal's Aniansi Diaz-Cortez and our partner Kate Doyle from the National Security Archive uncover information that points to new leads in the case. But first, we pick up the story with Omar's move to Washington and how that ends up putting him on a path back to Mexico.
Bueno, ahora estamos aquí en el departamento donde
yo... Omar, Kate, and I are standing in front of a cream-colored brick building in the Adams Morgan neighborhood of Washington, D.C. We look up at the windows of a small apartment. It's where Omar lived when he first got here in 2016.
After I left Mexico, I dragged around 2 suitcases, a couple of books, my camera, my Mexican wrestler mask, things that were symbolic for me.
It was a bare-bones existence. But Omar remembers he was just excited to be working on the case again. Jim Cavallaro had put together a small team that Omar joined.
And then I get to Washington and they hadn't done anything about the case.
Nada.
Nothing.
Nada.
And so Omar decides to dig into the case. He starts combing through the Mexican government's case files. Hundreds of reports and interviews. He's looking for key facts, witnesses, contradictions. it takes over Omar's life and his apartment.
Mi departamento estaba forrado por hojas.
My apartment was covered in papers. I would scribble things on them.
Este estuvo aquí, este estuvo acá.
I would say to my friends, okay, go in.
Pero miren los muros.
Don't look at the walls.
His friends think he's kind of losing it. His head in clouds of smoke from chain smoking. When he takes what he learned back to his coworkers at the Organization of American States, they don't take him seriously. They tell him,
come on, Omar. You are not a CSI. This is not your job.
For a few months, Omar plods along like this, working pretty much alone. Then he's invited to dinner by one of his old bosses in the Ayotzinapa case, former Guatemalan Attorney General Claudia Paz y Paz. She has dinner plans with her good friend, Kate Doyle, who's in town visiting.
And she said, oh, I've invited Omar. Remember Omar, our secretary? I was like, oh yeah, Omar, right, okay.
We learned in the last episode how Kate, who investigates human rights crimes, got involved in Ayotzinapa after being contacted by the lawyers of the parents of the missing students. At this point, Kate had only met Omar once. They all had dinner at a Mexican restaurant near Omar's home. Kate told me the story over Zoom a few months ago.
And there he was, just as like nice and smart and fun. And he smokes cigarettes, which I did too at the time. And he loves his mezcal or tequila. He's fun to be with.
Then they talk business. Omar about how he's been reading the Mexican government's enormous file about Ayotzinapa.
Oh my God. What did we not talk about on this case? You know, it all started with the intercepted text.
The intercepted text we told you about in our last hour that the DEA tracked between members of the drug cartel Guerreros Unidos. In the days before, during, and after the attacks on the students, text messages were going back and forth between gang members in Iguala, where the students disappeared, and the suburbs of Chicago, where heroin was being delivered in passenger buses. Kate and Omar feel these texts could help identify the attackers.
We meet with the Justice Department. We meet with members of Congress. We meet with the State Department. We call the U.S. Attorney personally. All kinds of creative ways that we could try to push on that door to get information from the U.S. government about what they knew.
And then, explosive news. Omar discovers that his phone had been hacked with an Israeli spyware called Pegasus. He says the Mexican government had been spying on him and the international experts when they were investigating the case.
Mi teléfono era como una central de llamadas.
My phone was like a switchboard for all of our calls.
De hablar con víctimas.
I spoke to victims, I spoke to sources, I spoke to everybody. So it had all our information.
Y que pues, posiblemente era toda información que tenía el gobierno sobre el caso.
And all that information the government now had about the case.
And back in Mexico, the government starts an all-out campaign to discredit the work Omar and the international experts had done. The report that exposed a giant cover-up by Mexican politicians, police, and members of the military. The government goes back to touting its original explanation of the attack on the students, the so-called verdad histórica, or historical truth. The parents of the missing boys don't believe them and do everything they can to keep the case in the public eye. They march, speak to the press, and try to meet with government officials, but they're turned down. Cristina Bautista, known as Doña Cristi, lost her son Benjamin in the attack. In April 2017, she and other families try to force a meeting with Mexico's Secretary of the Interior by just showing up at his office. When they get there, she says, the building is closed off by a metal fence.
They began to launch tear gas at us. Oh, I remember very well. And when I looked around, a young protester that was with us was badly hurt, drooling, crying on the ground in pain, until he fainted.
Entonces traía coca y le digo, regálame la coca, por favor.
Then I saw some girls that had Coca-Cola, and I knew that Coke helped with the pain, so I asked them, please, please, can I have your Coke? Then I ran to him and poured Coke on his face and mouth, and he woke up.
Fue terrible ese día.
It was terrible. All we wanted was to demand a meeting with officials, but they greeted us with tear gas.
Pero nos recibieron con gas lacrimógeno.
Omar follows the news in Mexico from D.C. It's painful to watch the case collapse without being able to do anything about it. But by summer of 2017, he's met someone he can confide in, a young lawyer from Texas named Helen.
Pasábamos como...
And we would spend entire nights talking about life, about stuff. And Helen would ask me a lot about the Ayotzinapa case. Helen became a part of a process of healing, to say things, to let them go, to talk through stuff. I don't think I had ever talked with anyone the way I talked to Helen in those days.
We met in August. We started dating in December. And like within 3 weeks, we lived together. And 2 weeks after that, I don't know, I think we'd just woken up. And I turned to him and I said, hey, do you want to get married? And he said, yes.
And in Mexico, things are shifting too.
¡Viva México! ¡Viva México!
Presidential elections are coming up in 2018. And a leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known in Mexico as AMLO, is leading in the polls. Doña Cristi remembers going to one of AMLO's rallies in the area where the students were attacked.
Andrés Manuel López Obrador was on the stage, totally blocked off, and security would not let us through. Then he saw us, and he told security, let them through. And I remember I spoke,
Señor Andrés Manuel López Obrador, por si llega a la presidencia.
If you become president, what are you going to do for our case?
¿Qué va a hacer por el caso Ayotzinapa?
I think the question touched his heart.
Le pegó en su corazón.
He teared up and said, because if I become president,
por si llego a la presidencia,
we will find out what happened that night.
Se va a esclarecer los hechos.
In July 2018, AMLO wins in a landslide.
On the streets of Mexico City, they celebrated a victory more than a decade in the making.
In December, he's sworn in.
La Constitución Política de los Estados Unidos Mexicanos.
With a new government in Mexico, Omar starts toying with the idea of moving back home. Kate remembers when he first brought it up.
You know, he would joke to me, well, yeah, I'm going to become a house husband. I'm going to get a dog. Just like, I think I'll just cook dinners and like be home with an apron on, you know, like that kind of thing.
And in early 2019, Omar and Helen moved to Mexico. She gets a job as an immigrant rights attorney. And a few months later, the new president announces he's going to reopen the Ayotzinapa investigation.
I said, so how's it going, house husband? And he's like, well, it's good, it's good. And I said, so tell me what's going on with the case and what do you think? And he said, well, you know, they're looking for a special prosecutor and they've asked a couple of people and they have said no, basically, they don't want to do it. And he said, I think I'm going to put my name in for it. And I said, wait, what? You're going to put your name in for special prosecutor, but don't you have to be a lawyer to do that? And he was like, I'm a lawyer. And I said, wait, you're a lawyer? I didn't know you were a lawyer.
Omar's wife, Helen, is all for it.
Like a week later, he got the call to go in and have the interview. He came back from the interview and he's like, I'm never going to get this job. It went horribly. This was a disaster. He spent the whole weekend depressed. And then at like 8:30 a.m. on Monday, he got the call.
It's a head-spinning turn. After fleeing Mexico and spending almost 3 years in exile for challenging the government's original investigation into the attack on the students, Omar will soon be the chief prosecutor of a new investigation.
Coming into his new position, Omar is determined to uncover the facts of the attack. But soon he finds out he's surrounded by people who still don't want the truth to get out. This is Reveal's serial investigation after Ayotzinapa. Chapter 3, All Souls.
Uncompromising quality doesn't just mean obsessing over every detail. American Giant also uses the power of local communities to make a difference. By forging relationships with local manufacturers, they've created what's been called the greatest hoodie ever made, their classic full-zip hoodie, while making an impact along the way. Explore American Giant's durable essentials at American-Giant.com and use code REVEAL at checkout for 20% off. That's 20% off at American-Giant.com. Code REVEAL. Support comes from Wealthfront. You can start investing in no time with Wealthfront's classic portfolio, or make it your own with things you care about, like socially responsible funds, technology, crypto trusts, or hundreds of other investments. Wealthfront was designed by financial experts to help you turn your good ideas into great investments without the hassle of doing everything yourself. To start building your wealth and get your first $5,000 managed for free for life, go to wealthfront.com/reveal. That's wealthfront.com/reveal to start building your wealth. Go to wealthfront.com/reveal to get started today.
Hey, 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 it's time for another Al's podcast pick. And this one is for Reveal listeners who speak Spanish. It's called Radio Ambulante. Every week, they tell stories from Latin America and U.S. Latinx communities. Moving, surprising, deeply reported stories about love and migration, youth culture and politics, about the big questions and the unique voices that are shaping the region today. You can find Radio Ambulante wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. In June 2019, Omar Gomez Trejo is sworn in as the chief prosecutor for Caso Ayotzinapa, the case of the 43 missing students. It's big news in Mexico.
Omar Gomez Trejo, maestro en derechos humanos.
Omar Gomez Trejo fue secretario
ejecutivo. Omar Gomez Trejo como fiscal especial para el caso Ayotzinapa.
A few months into his new position, Omar reconnects with Kate Doyle and starts communicating on a regular basis with her and Aniancy Diaz-Cortez, sharing his insider's perspective on what it's like to lead this case. In order to keep his identity secret while reporting this story, Kate and Aniancy always referred to Omar as the DJ instead of his real name. On trips to Mexico, they meet him in person, usually at his home.
Hi, Omar.
Hola. ¿Qué tal?
As special prosecutor, Omar now has the power to indict government officials who he suspects sabotaged the original investigation. He can follow up on leads that could expose who the attackers were and what they did with the students. During their visit, Omar and his wife Helen tell Aniancy and Kate that doing this job means adjusting almost every aspect of their daily life to keep them safe.
There are phones in the fridge. Helen, why do you make DJ put his phone in the fridge?
Because the fridge doesn't block the signal, but it does block the mic. That's what Edward Snowden taught us like 10 years ago.
Is your phone in the fridge, DJ?
Ahí vive, todo el tiempo.
It lives there, Omar tells me. He and Helen have gotten used to being super careful. They even make jokes about it.
Porque le gusta que su teléfono esté fresco.
He likes the phone to be fresh.
And then he gets serious.
O sea, yo parto de que siempre me están escuchando, incluso ahora.
I always assume that people are listening in on me, even now, without a cell phone.
And the threats go way beyond eavesdropping. So they've installed double-thick windows and security cameras in the apartment. A police car is always parked out front. Omar says his early days as prosecutor are brutal because the prosecutor's office, known as the Fiscalía, is filled with many of the same people who had hidden the truth about the case. He says one day he was given a file with some very sensitive information about people who worked for the previous administration.
I put the file on my desk, and at one point I get up and go talk to someone in the office about something. And when I come back, the file isn't there.
He goes to building security, and they get the surveillance video. It shows someone from his staff entering his office, picking up the folder and walking out with it.
Después voy, lo confronto.
And so I go to him, I confront him.
Niega la información.
He denies it. And my folder is sitting right there in his desk. I grab my file, go talk to his superiors. They don't want to do anything about it. That's when I realize I have to take much more drastic measures. And I begin firing people.
By the time he's finished cleaning house, Omar has fired most of the people working in his department. Dozens of them. The odds were stacked so high against him, Omar says, his bosses in the Mexican government had bets out that he would not last more than 3 months. And in that first week, Omar was put to the test. Just days before his appointment was publicly announced, a disturbing video was posted anonymously on YouTube. And we should warn you, the next few minutes of the story contain descriptions of torture that may be difficult for some listeners to hear. The video is about a minute long. It shows a man in a chair blindfolded with a plastic bag pulled tight over his head, about to be electroshocked. The man is Carlos Cantó. He was a middle school teacher in Iguala, the town where the students were attacked. He also owned a local bar there. He was one of dozens of people rounded up in government sweeps in the weeks after the boys went missing. Carlos ended up confessing, but the video is proof that it was forced. When the video was released, the new government under President Andrés Manuel López Obrador set him free and helped him and his family start a new life in a different part of Mexico. After that, he kept a low profile, never speaking to the press. Over the course of almost 2 years, Kate and I worked to contact him. We reached out to the UN Human Rights Office in Mexico, and they connected us to Carlos's sister. After several months, she arranges for us to talk to him. And eventually, we fly to the place where he's resettled, to meet him in person.
Buena tarde. Mi nombre es Carlos Canto Salgado.
My name is Carlos Canto Salgado. I'm 39 years old and married with 2 kids. This interview is important for me because I want to tell the truth.
Quiero contar la verdad de los hechos acontecidos.
Carlos is tall, looks athletic. He sits on a couch in his living room and plunges into his story, almost like he's been saving it up for this moment. On October 22nd, 2014, a little under a month after the students disappeared,
it was about 3 a.m. when we heard thumps at the door. Open, hurry. It's the federal police, the Navy, and they say they had an arrest order for me. I had no idea why. They stand me up, handcuff me.
They make him wait outside while they search his home and take some random things, a bag of clothes, a wad of plastic grocery bags.
One official turns to me. This is for the little trip we are about to take you on.
He says they wrap a shirt around his head so he can't see, push him into a car, and drive off. Carlos says they lead him to a deserted place on the outskirts of town and make him sit on the ground. A Marine sits down next to him and starts interrogating him.
The Marine said to me, how difficult you want to make this? And he asked me, where are the students? I don't know where the students are. He slaps me across the face. Please forgive me. I don't know where the students are. I'm a teacher. You guys are confused. You want to do this the hard way? He slaps me again. So, I have no idea where the students are. I don't know.
This is when, he says, they take his punishment to a new level.
One official brought out a shopping bag.
Sacaron las bolsas.
Filled up with plastic grocery bags.
Son de bolsitas de plástico.
What do they want with the bags?
¿Para qué quieren las bolsas, no?
They handcuffed me with my arms above my head. One officer sat on my legs and the other one on my chest.
Encima del pecho.
Question after question. The moment I answer, I don't know, I felt the first bag go over my head. And believe me, it's something I can't describe, what it feels like to have a bag over your head, to be deprived of air. I could not move. In complete desperation, my heart was racing at 1,000 miles per hour. I was trying to break the bag, anything to let a bit of air in.
Carlos says when it was nearly dawn, they stop and give him some clean clothes. They put him in a car and drive to Mexico City. He was blindfolded almost the whole time he was questioned there, but later found out he was on a military base.
Los marinos pegan más duro, eh?
Carlos says he was tortured multiple times and kept on denying the accusations. During one session, an officer walks up to him and takes off his blindfold.
¿Te lastima la claridad, no la luz?
The light hurts my eyes.
Y me muestra la fotografía de mi esposa.
He grabs his cell phone. He shows me a photo of my wife on his phone.
¿Qué quieres ver o oír lo que le vamos a hacer?
Do you want to see or hear what we are going to do to her? We have her right here.
Me empezaron a preguntar ahí por casas de seguridad.
They start asking me about safe houses, firearms, drugs, money, all these things I knew nothing about.
Aparte porque ya tenía la amenaza de mi esposa.
Because I fear what they do to my wife. I told them, I know about a house in such and such place. I just made it up.
He's allowed to clean up, and soon some official-looking people show up. Government bureaucrats. He says they hand him a document. It's his confession. He agrees to sign it, even though he's not allowed to read it. Carlos spends the next 5 years of his life in prison. He's never given a trial.
Fortunately, I believe in God. I think you seek him out in your darkest times. I began to pray to ask God, what about me? Why did you forget me? I think I asked him with such passion that only 2 or 3 days passed when I heard someone shout,
"Profe, ay, que salió un video de tu tortura."
Teacher, a video of your torture was leaked and it's on the news.
And
I'm like, nah, don't mess around. Yes, profe. A video of your torture came out and we saw a part of it. And yes, it was true. They turned on the TV and during the news break, there it was. I felt such a sense of relief. And I gave thanks to God. Here you are.
Carlos is set free and put on a bus home. He manages to buy a cell phone to call his family. And during the bus ride, he decides to Google his name. This next part is hard to listen to.
I went online to look for the video. I said, I'm going to watch it. When I finally watch it, oof. I felt like everything was closing. I struggled to breathe. I think I even cried on the bus the first time I saw what they were doing to me.
The leaked video of Carlos and his release are huge news during Omar's early days as prosecutor. But it wasn't the only one. In his investigation, Omar eventually gets a hold of more than 50 videos showing torture by government authorities. He wants to keep them confidential, but someone leaks a very explosive one. It includes Tomás Serón, the lead investigator for the previous government, who's accused of stage managing the cover-up. He's the architect of the so-called Verdad Histórica, the disproved theory that the 43 boys taken away by municipal police and a local gang were shot and incinerated at a garbage dump. In the video, Cerón's in a long, dark coat, with his hands in his pockets, pacing back and forth in a room with other interrogators. He's talking to a half-naked man sitting in a chair. The man's head is covered, his hands cuffed behind his back. "Let's get started," Seron tells him. "Tell me everything you know about the students." And a moment later... "The first time you BS me, I will kill you." For Omar, indicting Seron becomes a top priority, and he systematically gathers evidence. By February 2020, Omar thinks he has what he needs for an indictment. He wants Tomás Seron to face trial on charges that he ordered the torture of suspects to force them to confess, then put them in prison for years without trials. Finally, Omar goes before the judge with his evidence.
Yeah,
it was a very symbolic day. I remember this specific moment in which, after almost 3 hours, the judge said, "I'm granting you the arrest warrant against Tomás Seron for the following crimes." I went out to lunch with my team, and we had baby back ribs and two beers, and we had an arrest warrant under one arm.
But when the day came for Omar to serve the arrest warrant, Seron was gone. He'd fled the country. First, it was believed to Canada. Omar had Interpol put out a red notice for his arrest. And then there was word that Seron fled again, to Israel, which Kate started investigating to try and confirm.
The reason it made sense that he would be in Israel is that Tomás Seron is the person from the previous Mexican government who purchased that spyware Pegasus from an Israeli firm. That spyware Pegasus was used by Seron to infect the phones and surveil not just the five experts, international experts, but their executive secretary, Omar Gomez. So Seron already had an established relationship with powerful Israelis. So I called a reporter that I knew from the New York Times named Ronan Bergman, who works primarily on national security and intelligence issues from Israel. And he said he would try to track Seron down. Within about a week or two, I got a WhatsApp text from Ronan. He asked me if I was online. And when I said yes, all of a sudden a photo appeared on my telephone that was of a guy standing in a very small kitchen in a t-shirt with a scruffy face and a big goofy grin. And Ronan asked me, "Is this him?" And I really had to stare at this picture for a couple of beats because I've never seen Tomás Seron with a grin on his face like that. But I said, "Yeah, that's him." And the photo immediately vanished from my phone. And Ronan said, "He's here."
While Kate was doing her research, Omar and his team filed a formal request with the Israeli government to send Seron back to Mexico so he could face charges of forced disappearance, torture, and obstruction of justice. That was 2 years ago. So far, nothing has happened.
As important as Tomás Seron is to the investigation, there are many others. More than 50 people have been charged with crimes related to the missing students. These include local and state police, federal officials, and an officer in the military. In a moment, what Omar and his team are learning about the night of the attack and what was done with the students. You're listening to Reveal. Hey, 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 it's Al, and it's time for another Al's Podcast Picks. And this week, I want to tell you about a podcast that I absolutely love. It's called Slow Burn, and it's from Slate. Each season tells one story from American history. And this season, season six, my dude, Joel Anderson, who is an amazing journalist, is back in the host chair to examine the Los Angeles riots. So in 1991, a group of white police officers were captured on videotape violently beating Rodney King. This was the first time a lot of people in America had seen concrete visual evidence of police brutality against the black community. And it set off a chain of events that would shake the city of Los Angeles. Subscribe to Slow Burn, the LA Riots, wherever you listen to podcasts. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. As special prosecutor for the new Ayotzinapa investigation, Omar Gomez Trejo has two objectives. One is to figure out who was involved in the previous government's cover-up, people like Tomas Zeron, but more importantly, finding out what really happened on September 26, 2014, so families can finally learn where their sons are now. In our last episode, we heard a theory from a DEA agent who was convinced the students had stumbled onto a drug smuggling operation between Iguala, Mexico, and a suburb of Chicago.
More than 2,000 kilograms of heroin came to Chicago in a one-year period of time, which is an unprecedented, mind-boggling amount.
Mark Giuffre was following the drug traffickers and discovered they were using passenger buses, like the ones the students commandeered to smuggle heroin and cash. His guess? The students had taken a bus filled with hidden drugs.
These students hijacked the wrong bus. They hijacked the wrong bus.
Kate Doyle and Reveal's Aniyansi Diaz-Cortez wondered what Omar thought of this theory.
So you have said the buses, forget about the buses.
No.
Okay, well,
not like that.
All right, let me just... Right,
so on a visit to Omar's home in March 2020, they decide to bring up what Mark Giuffre had told them.
He said, when we finally got our hands on buses that were in Aurora, Illinois, carrying the drugs, after they had rounded people up, after they had informants, one of them was the engineer that designed the hiding place. He brought out his blueprints, and it was in the bumpers. And they went back to the buses and opened them up. So I just thought it was interesting and important to say to you because...
That was the same way as they send money back to Mexico?
Exactly.
The same way.
Yeah. All right. Same hiding place.
I know, sir.
Turn that off, Omar says to Aniyansi. He's intrigued. Up to now, this idea has been more like a conspiracy theory to him and his team. Then Kate and Aniyansi remind him about the text messages the DEA had intercepted between the drug smugglers, and that as part of their reporting, they've been trying to get the U.S. government to release them. In fact, Reveal is in a lawsuit with the government over this. After their meeting, Omar follows up on this lead and petitions the DEA from his end for the same information. Beyond figuring out who was involved in attacking the buses and why, Omar and his team launch a new series of searches looking for the remains of the students. Aniyansi explains.
In order to do searches, Omar has to cultivate sources first. People who know what happened to the students. He has leads from the enormous case file he read when he was living in Washington. And he interviews people with ties to the drug cartel who are in prison. In his first year as special prosecutor, he goes on a couple dozen searches.
It must have been so frustrating to carry out 20 y pico searches with no results.
Sí, o sea, sí hay un grado de frustración.
It can be really frustrating, Omar tells Kate. You leave in the morning with high hopes. Then mid-sentence, he switches to English.
Probably today is the day, and it's not the day. And you're going back to your house. To your office to say, well, just keep looking.
Then he tells us about this day in November 2019. It started off like most mornings, with Omar waking up before 5 a.m., greeting his bodyguards, then sliding into his bulletproof SUV. But instead of going to the office, they head toward Iguala and pick up one of the sources he's been talking to. This man was allegedly involved in the attack.
And
the source from there takes us to...
Es la Barranca de la Carnicería.
Do you know what Barranca de la Carnicería is in English? It's the butcher's ravine.
Es escalofriante.
It gives you chills, right?
Es camino al basurero de Cocula.
It's on the way to the Cocula garbage dump, but there's a detour about a kilometer below, which is through a ravine. So the source guides us there, and then he says, "Hey, fiscal, here, over here." And then the forensic expert arrives and says, "Yes, that's a human bone."
The source says, "Don't look for graves. The remains were just scattered under the trees and bushes." A few months later, six pieces of bone are carefully packed into a diplomatic briefcase, and Omar boards a plane to Innsbruck, Austria. He hand-delivers them to the scientist at the same DNA lab that identified the first student in 2014, Alexander Mora Venancio.
For me, it's very hard to take a diplomatic pouch with a bunch of remains that could be the students or could be anybody else. They were on the plane with me. In a way, the trip was encouraging because we could potentially identify more people.
But the results take weeks upon weeks, and the waiting is tough on Omar. Then, after 3 months...
Hello, hello. Today is Friday, June 19th, 2020. It's 10 p.m.
10 p.m.
And we're out here on the back terrace drinking some wine. What happened today, mi amor?
Today we receive information from the Innsbruck University that one of the DNA profiles match with one of the students. I'm very emotional now, very touchy. Because this represents the new era of the investigation of this case.
Can you talk a little bit about what it means, too, that you have identified one of the students, but...
I'm not ready. I can't talk about anything. I'm not ready.
We're not ready for that one yet. Okay. Yeah. You know, I'm really proud of you.
Days later, Omar's meeting with the family of Cristian Alfonso Rodriguez de Lumbre. He's the student whose remains were just identified. Luz María is Cristian's mother.
And they started to tell us that they found a bone fragment. Well, two little pieces of bone.
De un hueso salió la identidad de su hijo.
You're notifying the family about this little bone, saying it was found in such and such place with so and so characteristics, and all this work was done.
Que era una parte de su pie derecho.
It was part of his right foot. I was out of it, in a bad, bad, bad place. And then I snapped out of it and said,
un ser humano puede vivir sin ese pedazo de pie.
It's a very small fragment. A human being can live without a foot. And he tells me that's true. It's like they were telling me that he was dead.
¿Qué dices ahí?
What do you say to that? Nothing.
Nada.
Eventually, over 100 pieces of bone are found at the Butcher's Ravine. And another student is identified, Josivani Guerrero de la Cruz. That brings the total number of students identified to 3. Parents tell us they have faith in Omar's investigation, but they're frustrated too. It's all taking too long. And at the end of the day, most of them still don't have answers. All this time, I can't help but think about Doña Cristi, who lost her son Benjamin. We talk on the phone from time to time, and last year she invited us to visit her. Kate and I rent a van and drive 8 hours from Mexico City to her village.
I have a tiny bit of signal here.
Se perdió la señal del GPS.
Se perdió la señal del GPS.
We're so deep in the mountains, there's no GPS signal. You feel like you're driving into the clouds. The dirt road ends at Alpuyecancingo de las Montañas.
Buenas tardes. Con permiso.
Doña Cristi.
We arrive as Doña Cristi's in the kitchen, talking to her mother in her native Nahuatl, a language spoken across Mexico. This week is Todos Santos, All Souls, known as Muertos or Day of the Dead. In these parts, it's a deeply spiritual and sacred celebration.
Por fin, nuestro altar, colgando los muñequitos.
Doña Cristi's daughters, Laura and Meirani, are preparing the altar. They're hanging sugar breads in the shape of donkeys, deer, and angels on the altar. They explain to me that they're for their difuntitos, their dead. And they'll carry the ofrenda, or offering, back to the other side. Meanwhile, Doña Cristi is shelling corn to make atole, a hot corn-based drink. We talk about the family. I learned that Laura helped raise her little brother Benjamin when her mom went to the U.S. to work for a few years. The family needed the money for basic things like firewood and grain. It was hell, Laura says. Benja cried a lot as a baby, and she had to console him. As he grew up, he was different from most boys in the village. He was self-confident and fashionable. Meirani says he was the only kid in town who dared to wear pink. And he was a super talented dancer. When Laura got married, Benja walked her to the church. In this video, you see them dancing together. Benja in a pink button-down shirt.
En mi boda, y él se compró una camisa rosita.
He always hugged me, Laura tells us. Even though she's not a hugger and never hugged him back.
No le importaba. Te voy a abrazar.
Now she wishes she could hug him.
Tal vez arrepentirme.
The altar is ready. It's time to put on it the food and photos of loved ones who have passed away. Doña Cristi is directing her daughters, telling them where the food and drink should go. She begins to move a nearby photo of Benjamin toward the altar. Laura's eyes pierce Doña Cristi with rage and pain. And barely audible, she responds. Are you saying my brother is dead? Cristi pulls back apologetically. No, I was just saying I thought he should be there to remember him. But she pulls the photo away. Later, Laura tells us. He's alive. He's going to return. I can tell her younger sister Meirani doesn't see things that way, but she doesn't say anything. It's midnight when the dead are supposed to come to feast. The dogs know, Cristi and her daughters tell me. They can see the spirits, and they're welcoming them. The next day, before we leave, Kate and I sit down with Doña Cristi in Benjamin's room and struggle to pose our questions. How do you ask a mother about her missing child? If I learned anything from the families in these 2 years, it's that waiting for a loved one who has vanished can feel like dying slowly.
Está vivo, está todo lo que ha causado eso en usted y usted cómo lo ve ahora después de 6 años.
I try to ask without hurting her. After all these years, how do you go on?
Porque pues son 6 años y un mes que ha pasado.
Sea lo que sea, necesito la verdad.
Whatever happens, I need the truth. Despite all this time, she's going to keep looking for him, she tells me.
Lo voy a seguir buscando hasta encontrarlo.
Still, like other mothers I've spoken to, she finds ways to keep the memory of Benjamin alive. She tells Kate and me about a dream she had.
Que estaba en una ciudad, pero edificios grandes.
In a grand city, there's this house with an open door, and she walks in. A woman in a rebozo, a shawl, greets her.
Le quiero pedir un favor ahorita. Le digo así, ¿de qué?
I want to ask you for a favor.
In the middle of the room, there's someone sleeping who's covered with a blanket. She tells me, they left me to take care of him. He lost his memory. Can you watch him?
Sí, sí.
Yes. Who is it?
Ya se levantó.
Then he gets up. My son.
Mi hijo. Me dice, mami, escuché tu voz, dice. Me encontraste.
You found me. Look at how they hit me.
Cómo me golpearon. Por eso estoy fingiendo que no tengo memoria.
That's why I'm pretending I can't remember.
Pero escuché tu voz, mami.
But I heard your voice, mami. And I just hugged him.
Y que le dio, ay, papacito, yo que lo abracé. Digo, no, venga, vamos.
And I tell him, venga, let's go. But when I turn back to him,
desperté.
I woke up, but didn't see him. But for a moment, I felt joy. I got to see my son.
Desperté, ya no lo miré. Digo, ay, pero me alegré un ratito que sí lo vi, mi hijo.
This coming year, Omar Gomez Trejo's investigation could reveal new information about who was behind the attack and what happened to the missing boys. Trials are set to begin for some of the people accused of taking part in the ambush, disappearances, and government cover-up. The case for sending Tomas Zeron back to Mexico is now in the hands of Israeli prosecutors. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris has publicly pledged to help Omar's team get new information about the drug smugglers who were hiding heroin on buses between Iguala and the U.S. As for the remains of the students, searches are happening every 2 weeks. To see cell phone videos of the attack and documents related to the investigation, visit revealnews.org/disappeared. Our partners at Adonde Media are developing a Spanish-language version of the series. To hear a trailer and sign up to receive episodes in your inbox, visit adondemedia.com/Ayotzinapa or search Después de Ayotzinapa on your podcast app. Our lead producer is Aniansi Diaz-Cortez. Kate Doyle with the National Security Archive is our partner and co-producer for this series. Taki Telenidis edited the show. We have production help from Reveal's David Rodriguez and Bruce Heal. Thanks to Tom Blanton, Megan DeTora, and Claire Dorfman from the National Security Archive, and to Laura Starcheski, Lisa Pollack, John Gibler, and Ariana Rosas. Special thanks to Santiago Aguirre, Maria Luisa Aguilar from CentroPro, and Maureen Meyer from the Washington Office on Latin America. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help from Claire C. Note Mullen, Catherine Steyer Martinez, Stephen Rascon, and Jess Alvarenga. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kezar Campwala. Sumia Agarwal is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson. And remember, there is always more to the story. If you like what we do and you want to help, well, it's pretty simple. Just write us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's easy and only takes a few seconds. Just open the Apple Podcasts app on your phone, search for Reveal, then scroll down to where you see Write a Review. And there, tell them how much you love the host. Your review makes it easier for listeners to find us. And, well, it really does make a difference. And if you do it, you will get a personal thank you from me. Like, right now. Like, thank... Wait, not him. Not... No, you. Yes, you. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right.
From PRX.